The silent chorus after all the repeat and fade leaves me with no recollection of why I ran away. I still can't hear that song without thinking
sings and she plays the trombone. Aubrey Logan from her brand new CD. This is a tune called Remembering Song. We've got to give some props to the band.
We do.
I mean, they're absolutely amazing. You were singing with Dave Johnstone on drums and Tabari Lake on the bass back there. On the keyboards, Nick Petrillo. And you had Rebecca Jade and Jordan Michael singing with you.
I am one lucky girl, yeah.
Is it hard to keep a band together?
Well, not this one. We're stuck together. We're driving around in a Sprinter van all around the country, so they're stuck with me for the next couple of weeks at least.
Well, and you're staying very busy. I mean, you're playing a lot, you're performing a lot, and I mean, it's a lot of work doing this thing they call playing, isn't it?
It's a lot of work.
How do you get past the work part?
Well, I figure that the part where we get to play the music, makes it all worth it. I mean, you know, the joke goes, you know, you pay me to travel, but I'll do the show for free.
Right.
Because this part's the reward. So all of the songwriting and the grunt work and the business running and the traveling and the packing, it all really is worth it once you get to be on a stage or in a studio making music happen.
I think Dan Fogelberg said it best when he sang that the audience is heavenly, but the traveling is hell.
You know. So
let's get into your music, because that is why you're here, and you've got this wonderful band with you. This is a tune from her new album again. This is called High Place. It is Aubrey Logan on the Wood Songs, Old Time Radio Hour.
Let me talk about my high place. It's my place. I won't come down. Build hedges all around. There's only room for one of us in this town. I don't know how long I've been here. I don't care. I'm comfortable. Is it so terrible that I forgot what life is like on the ground? Oh, I climbed up this ladder such a long time ago. The rusted rungs have rotted in the cold December snow. And it would take eternity to scrub them all clean. The only way down is to fall in her arms again. But then I wouldn't. Let me talk about my high place. It's my place. You have to go. I'll turn on my radio. And where some earbuds that I won't even know. Won't even know.
I'll wear some earbuds and they won't even show. I won't even know. I won't even know.
The female version of Mel Torme there. Wasn't it great having Aubrey Logan on the broadcast with her trombone and her full band? This week's Woodsongs kid, Ellie Hack, 10 years old. The incredible Galen Lee. Do you know what Aubrey Logan, do you know what our Woodsongs kid, Ellie Hack, and do you know what Galen Lee all have in common? Somewhere along the road, there was a supportive music teacher. There was somebody in their path that was a music teacher that helped them go on the journey that they're on to be brave enough to go on this artistic road, and all three have been doing spectacularly well had it not been for a music teacher. And it begs the question, why on earth are so many schools taking music and art out of the budgets out there when that's probably the most important thing to creating a good life, to make your livelihood worth it? Back during World War II, some reporter went up to Winston Churchill and asked him, are you going to remove the arts from the government budget in order to pay for the war effort? And supposedly, Winston Churchill looked at the reporter square in the eye and said, well, then what the heck are we fighting for? Get out there and fight for music and art in your schools. My name is Michael Jonathan. I'm a folk singer. I am a song farmer. We'll see you next week on the Woodsongs
Old Time Radio.
Good night.
You've been listening to Woodsongs broadcast number 953. Michael's opening song was The Cabin from the Walden album.
Our chief engineer is Jerome Galt. Technical assistants are Brian Clausing, Brandon Eves, Mark Thompson, and Eric Anderson. Our TV and internet broadcast is directed by Maria Claridge. Technical director was Whitney Hannon and assisted by Chris Browning.
The Woodsongs crew member of the week is Tina May, and our Woodsongs partner of the week is Brenda Menino.
Special support provided by Highbridge Springwater, Nate's Coffee, the staff of the Lyric Theater, and Bourbondon Toulouse in Lexington.
Our show is produced with the support of VisitLice.com, the Mark Kintahard Company, Deering Banjos, Travel Host Magazine, the Bluegrass Hospitality Association, and the Holiday Inn Express Newtown Pike in Lexington, welcoming visitors from all over the world to Lexington, Kentucky.
Woodsongs and the Woodsong symbol are registered trademarks of Rachel Aubrey Music. Our show is distributed worldwide by Woodsongs Radio Network and PRX. Thanks for listening. I'm Josh Baer.
For Michael Jonathan and the entire Woodsongs crew, this is Dorothy Edwards. We hope you'll join us again next week for the Woodsongs Old Time Radio Hour.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency of Canada.
Smoking gun. That's such a pretty girl, I'd call down the moon on this nasty situation, but I'm afraid of what I might see. Can you feel it? The beating of the heart. It never stops. Can you feel it? The fear. It never stops. It's the fuel. It's the fuel. And it feels so good. You're such a pretty girl.
Hey, Al, who are you talking to?
Shut up and dig.
I marvel at my friend William. Sleeping, he dreams of answers to his problems. I've never been able to do that, I said to him. Well, all that proves, he replied, is that your super conscious is more stupid than you are. The reason that I'm not Machiavellian, I mean the real reason I'm not Machiavellian, is either because I'm honest and open and steadfast to a very high ideal, or because I have a total lack of ambition. Well, I hope that it's a total lack of ambition, because that is something that can last a lifetime. I am the least Machiavellian person I know. I am the least Machiavellian. I am the least Machiavellian. The least Machiavellian person I know. I know.
I'm so responsible. If I had a hidden agenda, I'd lose it.
Well, all that proves, he replied, is your superconscious is more stupid than you are. That's a concept I like. The idea that your hidden intelligence could be smarter or dumber than your conscious personality. Maybe you have intuitive capacities far in excess of your humdrum knowledge brain, but maybe your intuitive capacities are a primitive and untrained relic of an evolutionary history that has no clue how to deal with the current nuances and contradictions of reality. And if your hidden intelligence is somehow dumber than you, how could you make it smarter? Wouldn't it be nice if the back of your mind could be trusted to instinctively do a lot more things for you? Anyway, that was a rare piece of Canadiana, The Least Machiavellian by Alan George. I'm currently reading a very interesting and counterintuitive biography of philosopher, politician, and comedy playwright Niccolo Machiavelli. And that's why today's episode of the increasingly inaccurately named Cinematic Asylum is going to be all about books, instead of about the cultural issues that pervade television and film. Now, I know you're probably saying that a whole radio show just about a couple of books I happen to like is about the laziest topic imaginable, that I'm really scraping the bottom of the barrel now, but it's actually a lot worse than you think. This is a redux, a slight modification of a show I already did. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM, and I'm Layman Pascal. Welcome to the show.
I'm Larry, this is my brother Daryl, and that's my other brother Daryl.
Ha 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 ha
right then. That was Bebo's Zen Drums from the credits of episode 5 of the 6th and final season of tech sitcom Silicon Valley. Well, all right then. Well, which books would I recommend? Who knows? I can tell you which books I've tended to reread a lot. That's probably a good place to start. You know, I've slowly concluded that rereading is probably more important than reading. If you could choose between reading 10 new books and reading one really challenging book 10 times, it's the latter option that probably creates depth of understanding, while the former just adds to your superficial knowledge hoard. I like to reread Nietzsche because he's so weird and jaunty and twisty and deliberately says things to mislead the reader about his actual opinion. It's great.
Well,
I wish I could read it in German. I've heard people say the original prose is quite beautiful. Some of that even comes across in various English translations. That's a good sign. I think your stuff is unique and stylish. If even when all the words have been replaced by the words of another language, it still seems unique and attractive.
Well, all right then.
Genealogy of Morals by Fred Nietzsche is one of his more fantastic writings. I think it's the second thing he wrote after his religious awakening in the mountains. From his early life, he'd been seeking the secrets of cultural regeneration. His first book, which he later criticized and distanced himself from, was seeking for something he called a musical Socrates, perhaps something like what that disreputable 1970s post-Hindu mystic Osho Rajneesh would later call Zorba the Buddha, a character capable of unearthing cultural pathology, separating healthy from unhealthy ideals, and reigniting a spiritualized civilization of robust health and evolutionary subtlety. He identified this character he was looking for a little too much at the time with the intense, emotionally evocative, stormy, and longing-filled music of Richard Wagner, with whom he was at that time close friends. He saw then a great dichotomy between the Dionysian and Apollonian, between the unconscious and conscious, between art and trance, between fixing the chaotic world by tidying it up into luminosity, or fixing it by entering into peak experiences where everything feels perfected no matter how apart it is. But there were no clear answers here. Looking back, he seemed to feel that book was romantic, almost pre-modern, a phase in which he took the emotional passions of symbolism and the archaic as the essential thing that had to be re-stimulated and recovered in order to produce cultural awakening. Later, he'd pass through his human-all-too-human phase and become a great critical proponent of science, rationalism, evolution, and post-metaphysics. But naturally, he later came after that to complain about the implicit metaphysics in post-metaphysics, the hidden irrationality of the rationalists, and how modern science couldn't quite give us a solution to the problems of deeper culture and better human beings any more than simple retro-romanticism could. So he was bearing this puzzle with him into the storm, the mountains, and out of that stormy mountain cloud came the lightning, a subtle quasi-visionary teacher who erupted into his soul with a musical, dancing, ultra-affirmative, non-religious religion that expressed itself in the long, surrealistic teaching poem we call Thus Spake Zarathustra. That was a turning point, I think. For me, I really only read the stuff he wrote after Zarathustra. Here, he's happy, completed somehow, aware that a strange hybrid of aesthetic and cognitive power has erupted into a spiritual potency with a new message, a prophecy, a calling that fulfills culture and religion while tearing them both to pieces. The rhythm, the Dionysian rhythm that expressed itself in the Apollonian form of thought and philosophy, the resolution of his early dualism between Dionysus and Apollo, they burst forth together as a voice in a series of peak experiences. And after that time, he begins to write in an utterly new style, or with the apotheosis of the style he's been trying to bring forward all along. It's happy, triumphant, sly, apocalyptic, and mysteriously redemptive. He's heard a tone, it seems, that for him is the solution now to every puzzle and is the beginning of every nuance. His next books were attempts to concretize that experience in the form of more reasonable and polemical insights rather than just triumphant spiritual poetry. So first he writes Beyond Good and Evil, which is a pretty amazing book, but then he writes Genealogy of Morals, a series of very peculiar essays. It's about the difference at the beginning. First, he wrote Beyond Good and Evil, a pretty amazing book, but then he wrote Genealogy of Morals. It's a series of very peculiar essays. The first one is about the difference between good and bad and good and evil. And then there's about how the different versions of morality evolve from feelings of strength and feelings of weakness and discontentment with life, about the relevance of the ascetic priest, and what does it mean when a living organism can promote values that oppose life? To be in favor of sacrifice, celibacy, surrender, giving up the reasoning mind, not eating, these could be signs of a totally degenerate organism, or they could be situations in which artists and philosophers try to build up their power and inspiration and focus. The problem of the ascetic ideal. In that section, in that book, he speaks very powerfully about the need for perspectives. Famously, in his notebooks, he wrote something like, "Our task is to see things as they are. Our method is to look through millions of eyes." Here in The Genealogy of Morals, he critiques the normal notions of objective in favor of the urge to take new perspectives. He speaks of the will to see things differently, the will to take and assimilate another perspective as a way of building up the power, complexity, and extent of our own understanding, a way of being powerful over our own opinions rather than trapped beneath or within them. This is his alternative to the standard attempt to be merely and usually falsely factual, objective, and pragmatic. The complaint here is that people who imagine they're factual, impartial, objective, pragmatic, and reasonable also conceal a secret bias and anxiety. Possibly even opposed to the very principle of life to be utterly impartial and dispassionate and objective. Life itself is a kind of preferencing or privileging. It isn't neutral. It wants to grow and survive and enhance and deepen. So people who pretend they have no preference in a matter, that they are simply the judicious considerers of the objective situation, well, they're almost always jerks. People who want to be thought of as superior and who want to be able to dismiss everyone else as biased so that their own bias can triumph. Or worse, they're people who hate life itself because life is not objective in some evolutionary sense and favors development. But there's a greater virtue. Yet there is a great virtue to clear thinking, to more complex thinking, to not being so biased. A great judge like King Solomon may be among the greatest souls produced by the human species, but not because of his impartiality, rather because of his ability to rise above his own set of limiting perspectives. His willingness and even desire to take multiple perspectives and to weigh them out, not necessarily to agree with what comes up for him, to look for another angle, the will to see it another way is what Nietzsche in The Genealogy of Morals promotes as the real virtue that gives us the power we formerly attributed to objective practical thinkers, but without the obscene self-satisfaction and vanity of people who simply believe they're being objective, pragmatic, and unbiased. That's an idea I could reread many times. Here's to Narwin.
انت الشاش هرست اقل سلوا الاسراف شلغتاي هان الكاس هزر شلهي عزيز انت رست قلب
زلوا الأسراف هادس نقاد ناموا ساسلاف شوي غدا يبان الكاس عزا سلهين أعطي أنت
in Washington are worried about strange objects in their neighborhood. Sheriff Weir Klim says he has received several reports of a strange egg-shaped object about 200 feet long landing on highways last night. Sheriff Klim says he even himself got a glimpse of the thing, which somehow turned off lights and auto engines when it came near. The sheriff says that lights and engines worked fine again after the thing went away.
One day all the UFOs buzz the Capitol, spinning all their fiery wheels ecclesiastical, drove the population to a spasm panicle. The general started acting rather geriatrical. It might be the right time to take sabbatical. These aliens are acting super diabolical. Hey, get me Air Force One on the hotline radio. But excuse me if you lose me to a space raid rodeo. What the hell you gonna do when the world, what the hell you gonna do when the world ends? What the hell you gonna do when the world ends? Oh, tell me how you gonna win. On our anal cavity, there were no earthly bounds on their depravity. If that weren't bad enough, they disrupted gravity. We floated in the air along with all of our TVs. They canceled social media, and that's when we awoke. We're drifting through the air. Hey, is this some kind of joke? they got a great big kick from all our aggravation. But we weren't gonna lay down for no alien invasion. What the hell you gonna do when the world, what the hell you gonna do when the world ends? What the hell you gonna do when the world ends? Oh, tell me, tell me, tell me, tell me how you gonna win. Graviton disruptor, our feet back on the ground. We rallied all our thunder, did excellent defenses until we found their blemish, our science.
CILU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
The Foundry at 242 Red River Road, open 11 a.m. to 2 a.m. Monday to Saturday, featuring folk in Mondays, karaoke Tuesdays, trivia Wednesdays, open stage Thursdays, and live music weekends. Find out more at thefoundrypub.com. the Thunder Bay Symphony Orchestra. Log on to tbso.ca or call 626-TBSO for details on the 2019-2020 season and how to get tickets. The Lakehead University Student Union, promoting action, advocacy, and service by bringing you student centers. Learn more by visiting their office in the tunnels of the student center or by logging on to lusu.ca.
Thank you. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Now let's look at who's been running this country since World War II. They have some involvement in all of this. What is the link? What do cars have to do with books, you might ask? The Trilateral Commission with the Council on Foreign Relations. You ever hear of them? Well, neither did I, until I noticed the chain of coincidence. They have members on the boards of all the largest corporations. Not one detail has been left out. Am I right? Do you feel it?
Yes.
Do you know what Bobby Ray Inman was doing before he was running the Microelectronics and the Computer Tech Corporation? Well, guess. A CIA director. It's public knowledge. Do you run out of Kleenex, paper towels, and toilet paper at the same time? You know it's true.
It's all true.
You remember how Governor White campaigned to get the MCC here. Do you know what their goal is? Huh? Well, Elvis did. Artificial intelligence? Huh? Robots? Oh, they'd like that, wouldn't they? Yes, sir. Sleep, sleep. One and one is not equal to. No, sir. No, sir. Silicon Gulch, Silicon Prairie, Silicon Hills, Silicon Valley. You better wake up. It's late. It's late. It's late. You got the CBS and the ABC. You got Time and Newsweek. They're the same to me. Now don't you wanna get right with me? I hope you get everything you need.
Positive evidence.
Well, it's a
positive evidence. Positive evidence. Positive evidence. Stop hugging your heart.
Oh, hugging your heart. You're listening. And your MasterCard.
Positive evidence.
Got what you wanted, lost what you had.
Positive evidence.
I'm seeing
positive evidence. Positive evidence. Positive evidence. I'm hugging your heart.
Hugging your heart. All right. What I'm saying is brave.
It's true.
All right,
Welcome back to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Layman Pascal, and today I'm just describing some books I like. Or rather, books I've reread. It's not totally clear that I like them. We covered Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals, so what's next? Well, if you love long, convoluted, high-tech action-adventure stories with a ton of information about the real world to flatter your vain, self-preening intellect, then you'll probably love Neal Stephenson novels. If you're actually interested, say, in a 10-page discussion of the physics of stair climbing while several Hong Kong mafia thugs are ascending those stairs with submachine guns and augmented reality helmets to attack a nest of Somalian transgender hackers, then Neal Stephenson is probably for you. And if you want to be sure that Mongolian sword fight scene is metallurgically and performatively accurate, well, Neal Stephen might be for you. Stephenson. Full disclosure, people recommended him to me for years, and I wouldn't read him because I don't like recommendations. In fact, I won't even click on links if you send them to me. I get subliminally offended if someone sends me a link to a video or article. Rather than telling me what they liked about it or showing me they can summarize information, they instead just make a mute pointing gesture towards something. Disgraceful. And it makes fun of mute people, which is also deeply offensive to me personally, since I sometimes don't talk for long periods of time. I mean, isn't part of the problem today this sense of information overload without clarification, without sufficient meaning? And how can we get meaning if we're always showing it receding to the horizon, withdrawing to the vanishing point, sliding off to the next signifier, displacing itself to yet another website, retreating to another node in the network, moving on to another provider, jumping, sliding, escaping, pointing on and on and on beyond itself, showing you always this endless little gap between your current condition and the information that might satisfy you. I don't even want to see credits and title sequences. I'm crazy about this. Just get on with it. Why is there an extra step? Don't introduce the speaker and tell me how wonderful and official he is. I'll make up my own mind after listening for a couple of minutes. I'm tired of being shown and promised that information is just a step away. This link is the basic symbol of a vast evil. It promises connection and access, but you always just have to do one more little thing. Sure, it's the simplest possible thing in the world, but it's symbolic of everything that has to be done first, of every gesture toward information rather than immediacy of information. So that's why I never read Neal Stephenson, because that's how I feel about recommendations, like I'm being offered a mute pointer toward information. If I only cross this valley, leap this hurdle, follow this finger, take the next step, sign up, check it out later. Ah! Anyway, years later, I did come across an audiobook of Stevenson's novel Anathem in the Victoria Public Library. Had a cool cover, like monks, M.C. Escher Monastery, creepy clock. I took it home to check it out. Probably passed out listening to it. Never got more than a few pages in. Gave up. Year later, tried again. Same thing. Put me into a trance. Out I went. The thing was, half the words in that novel are made up or hybrids. The action takes place in the future in a parallel dimension where there's a slightly different history, slightly different plants, slightly different slang, slightly different everything. So every word is meaningful, but doesn't reveal its meaning to you immediately. And that's one way to introduce a trance, because you stimulate the unconscious mind that has to handle non-specified meaning. What do I mean by non-specified meaning? Well, I mean, you're familiar with wrenches, obviously. You know wrenches are very important in order to get certain jobs done. There are certain very important jobs that can only be done, let me tell you, with the help of a good wrench. But what if I told you it's even more important, even more essential for getting those same jobs done, to have a good flinger? I know people aren't as familiar with flingers as they are with wrenches, but I'm sure you can still appreciate how crucial it is for a workman who seriously wants to accomplish his task to have a good flinger when a flinger is the right tool, maybe the only tool, for the job. I've personally had a lot of near disasters in home repair when I tried to make do without a decent flinger. One time I tried to make do with just a wad of aluminum foil, an elastic band, and a turkey baster. Don't laugh, but it was no substitute for a good flinger. And flingers, as everyone knows, were invented as recently as the 17th century in the Netherlands. Before that, as you can imagine, people had to use a Krombach flingers. And as good as today's Model 3 of Krombach flingers might be, you can imagine what 17th century flingers were like. Sounds silly, but it's actually very, very important and sometimes can mean the difference between life and death to have the flinger you need. So what am I talking about? Well, I'm showing you what it's like when words seem both important and unfamiliar. If I kept talking about flingers and flungers like that for 20 minutes and you by some miracle kept listening, you'd probably blank out and wake up a few hours later, well rested, but with no clear idea how you got all those skee ball tokens in your pocket. So the third time I tried listening to the audiobook of Neal Stephens' Anathem, I was finally familiar enough with his terminology to follow the story. A very interesting world of pop culture idiocy, conspiracy, and science monasteries. The main character is a monk apprentice to a heretic whose peculiar ideas have become very relevant once the world has been visited by a spacecraft traveling from apparently several nearby dimensions. The main idea of this heretical monk is that consciousness is distributed between or across the multiverse in the Everettian many worlds sense of that term. He postulates that conscious mental activity is essentially the result of many different potential scenarios being compared in order to help us navigate toward our desired evolutionary outcomes. Evolution has sculpted this pragmatic orientation, but it depends on our capacity to compute many competing scenarios. Costly in terms of time and energy and brain resources to generate and run all these counterintuitive different scenarios, but it wouldn't be nearly so costly if our brains didn't have to generate models, but could just scan nearby quantum universes where all these things might actually be already happening. Why imagine imaginary things if all possible things are already actual happenings? Just touch in with the brains of the versions of you in nearby compatible universes, and the exchange creates a low-cost ability to evaluate alternative outcomes and navigate more successfully in the evolutionary sense. So the classic question of whether or not our minds make contact with ourselves and other versions of reality, if that's what turns out to be the physically real interpretation of quantum mechanics, as many scientists now believe, well, that question just goes away in the world of this novel. You don't have to make contact with yourself in another reality. Your experience of your mind right now is already something operating between different multiverse outcomes. Consciousness is a many-worlds phenomenon. Possibly it's even the space between the worlds. That would jive nicely with a lot of mystical experience that people have had over the years. Not me, of course. Other people.
This is a day upon which we shall make some remarkable discoveries concerning that inner realm which is a part of your consciousness this very moment.
This is a test. 1, 2, 3. This is a test. 1, 2, 3.
Please let me introduce you to a brand new idea. It ain't like your stupid car, cause it don't come from Korea. I won't charge you for this tip, but you can take it to the bank. And when your whole life starts to turn around, you'll know who to thank. Thank God for MC-900 will be the first thing you say when you're jumping out of bed at the start of every day. Dropping on your knees while you're calling out my name, saying thank you, thank you, thank you, and you'll bless the day I came into your life. Which up to this point has been a big fat joke. You were playing on yourself, but now it's time you awoke from this dream you've been having and confront reality. So shut your mouth for 1 minute, pay attention to me. The point I'm trying to make contains my whole philosophy. So,
Listen to what I tell you and repeat it after me. Truth is out of style. Truth is out of style. Truth is out of style. Truth
is out of style.
Truth
is out of style.
I hear what you're saying. MC 900 Foot Jesus. Exactly how did you come to the conclusion that truth is out of style? Well, I was on my way to work one day. I spied a rocket ship. Some aliens abducted me and took me on a trip to a previous existence on another astral plane. I met a real nice lady there named Shirley MacLaine. The truth is not an obstacle for someone such as me, she said, because, you see, we all create our own reality. And if a problem should arise, the best thing you can say is don't worry, be happy, and have a nice day. Well, I thank her very kindly for the excellent advice. She said she'd bill me later at a reasonable price. Then the aliens brought me back and beamed me down into this bar. But I could not go to work because Bigfoot stole my car. Truth is out of style. Truth is out of style. Truth is out of style.
Out of sight.
Yet it has been proved.
But just listen to this letter to the editor. Dear sir, as we stand at the threshold of a new century, what hope can there be for the fate of mankind? Anarchists strike at the very heart of civilization. Our youth lack any sense of direction. And each day the newspapers carry fresh stories of appalling murder and violence in the streets. As dated Larkspur, March 14th, 1901. Going into my weekly column, 100 years ago today, those who do not know history are condemned to repeat the mistakes of the past. Knowing history enables us to concentrate on making new mistakes.
Thank you.
The truth is out of style.
Truth is out of
and
style.
A titch of the Silence of the Lambs,
main theme soundtrack.
Canada's
favorite.
Most prominent film composer, Howard Shore. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Layman Pascal, just randomly describing books I've read. Here's another book I read. Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow was a bit of a revelation for me. Anyway, it lingered with me. It took the ancient esoteric idea of multiple hidden human intelligences, multiple consciousnesses, and inner psychic or intrapsychic community of the soul, and showed how far you could update that idea with current social and scientific methods. Kahneman, of course, is famous for helping give birth to behavioral economics, which is sort of a way of thinking about economics that involves how people actually behave rather than how we imagine they might behave in a perfect system. There's this old trope about how standard economic discourse revolves around the idea that each individual is a perfectly rational, perfectly well-informed, perfectly selfish person who's perfectly able to understand what they hear about and take action on it. Whether or not the financial markets and pricing systems would operate well under those conditions, we are certainly not under those conditions. I.e., most people are not mostly rational, selfish, and well-informed. Perhaps an occasional sociopath or brain injury victim might approximate the kind of traditional economist mind that they pretend we have, but really we don't. So, in general, the economy doesn't work for a lot of us, at least not in the ideal sense. But we're not just not the kind of people economists think we are, we're also not the kind of people we think we are. Kahneman spent his life working on clarifying cognitive biases and seemingly irrational human modes of thinking, feeling, and behaving. He did a study of judges that revealed they were more lenient at the beginning of the day and after lunch. They are more severe and mean to people just before lunch and at the end of the day. Why? Well, it takes blood glucose for their brains to do the complex balancing of arguments and empathy. Objectivity and empathy and intentional focus burn fuel. They're costly. When the fuel drops, we get less objective and less interested in others and less responsive to complicated information. But most of the time, we don't notice this is happening. We still